John, here we are, another Monday morning, another 10:31 timestamp recap.
Every week, another timestamp, another Sunday night Bitcoin dump to get the juices flowing.
Hey, the liquidity alarm bell's going off. I just recorded with Michael Howard, just talking about it. It looks like liquidity is turning over. We've peaked in the liquidity cycle, going to a liquidity trough. But we're not here to discuss that. We're here to discuss the timestamp. Rain, snow, sleet. We'll get through it. We just got 30 inches of snow here in the Philadelphia area. I've got kids home from school crying downstairs. I can hear them right now. I apologize if you can hear them too, but the show must go on. If you haven't subscribed to the 1031 timestamp or know what we're doing here, John writes a newsletter for 1031 every Saturday. It goes out. You can sign up for that at 1031timestamp.com. That's TEN31timestamp.com. Make sure you get on the list. And this week, we're talking about the reality distortion field, a concept that Steve Jobs popularized. Why did you decide to lead off with this week, John?
Yeah, it popped into my head this week after seeing a couple headlines. I couldn't get it out of my mind, this idea. For those who haven't read the Jobs bio or seen the various biopics of him over the last 20 years, he's known for having a level of, some would say charisma, some would say brilliance, some would say abusive personality, whatever, you know, some combination of all of them, as most mercurial founders kind of often do. You know, he had the ability through all those different things to warp reality to his liking, right? To get people to do things that anyone else would have dismissed as like structurally or like physically impossible, these feats of engineering and product design that everyone else would have thought impossible. And he just, you know, basically brute forced it into reality. And it kind of occurred to me, like, as I was looking at headlines this week, everyone kind of has their own reality distortion field, but it usually, for most people, it just kind of runs in the other direction. Like, you take reality and then you mold it in your head and in kind of like, you know, groupthink with those around you to kind of massage it into a narrative that is flattering to your preconceived notions about the way the world works or how you want it to work. And everybody is that way. I'm that way. Marty's that way. So no special kind of carve out for us here. You know, it's like the Garfield meme. You are not immune to propaganda. And that's true for everyone. But I feel like you really see it excessively in kind of late stage sclerotic institutions like we kind of have right now. And there were just a couple examples of that this week that I feel like really are a good microcosm for the way that our institutions are trending and the way the world's trending, I mean, kind of the developed Western world. And so one of them is the Supreme Court ruling against Trump, President Trump, and his tariff agenda, originally authorized under IEPA, which is a 70s kind of Emergency Powers Act, and in a 6-3 decision that included some Republican appointees, Trump appointees, kind of going against him, you know, overturning that and saying that he can't use IEPA to justify those tariffs. And you saw quickly like this cascade of kind of celebratory headlines in, you know, certain mainstream media outlets saying, you know, this is a massive defeat for Trump, a massive blow to his agenda. And without having any opinion one way or the other on the quality of this idea, the quality of tariffs, the desirability of them, whatever, that's a whole different thing we can get into. But, you know, it just, to me, just seemed like such a weird kind of victory dance that people were doing if you didn't like Trump, because as this convenient chart from Bloomberg shows, and as Trump and Bessin and Lutnick and the rest have been previewing for like a year, there are many other kind of ways to skin this cat from the executive branch. I think over the weekend already, maybe it was Section 301, the one in the middle was basically rolled out to justify a new set of blanket tariffs. But the point is, like, we've clearly entered a different stage of like global commerce. The global economic reordering is proceeding apace. And, you know, the Trump administration and his officials are just not going to look at a Supreme Court decision and say, well, you know, rats, we would do this key bulwark of our economic and policy agenda, if not for that dastardly Supreme Court. And I guess now we can't do it because, you know, checks and balances. You know, the reality is, like, because of the way that America has progressively installed more and more kind of unaccountable executive power in the executive branch, as illustrated by, you know, this set of options that is still before Trump, this is like happening one way or the other. And I think it's interesting to watch the financial press act like there's any reality in which Trump just throws up his hands and says, oh, well, I guess I can't do it. And it just says a lot about the divided reality that kind of we still live in, where a certain constituency has a dominant narrative that they'll use to kind of mold what they see as reality. And then there's kind of reality itself, which seems to be maybe going progressively in the other direction.
It is laughable. I mean, we're 11 years into the Trumpian politic, if you will, if you include his campaigning for the 2016 election in that time scale. And it's just, will anybody ever learn? He's going to get his way one way or another, whether or not, again, to your point, we agree with the way in which he gets it, doesn't really matter. He's going to get his way. And it was funny. I think Scott Bessent had a presser, what was it, Friday afternoon, like within hours of the Supreme Court ruling. Well, okay, here we're pivoting to enact the tariffs in these ways, through these means and in these avenues. The show must go on. And then Trump quickly followed up with, all right, 10% tariffs across the board. You know what? Wait, actually 15% now. And so we live in this very, very weird reality.
Yeah. You know, the subtitle for this week was "There's no fishing in the Rubicon," which is like an image I really like of, you know, Caesar famously crossing the Rubicon, this pivotal moment in kind of the fall of the Roman Republic. And, you know, saying perhaps apocryphally, like the die is cast, the die has been cast. This is like going, you know, this image of kind of going across this line that you can't go back from. You know, you don't go halfway across the line and then like sit there in the river and fish. Like, if you go, you got to go. And I think over the last year, so much has been said by both Trump and people in his administration and industry leaders, right? Not even just Trump himself, but like companies kind of, even if they're just currying political favor, like CEOs acknowledging the erosion of the industrial base in the US and the position that puts us in from a defense perspective, a national security perspective, you know, outsourcing everything to China to the point that we can't go to war without China's permission. Like that was always happening for decades, but now like the band-aid's been ripped off and everyone knows that everyone knows because of this past year, because of what Trump's done this past year. And so once you start down that road, you know, you don't go back. You don't get to say like, well, the Supreme Court said I can't use IEEPA for the tariffs, so I guess we're just going to, you know, let's all let bygones be bygones and act like that didn't happen. Like everyone knows that everyone knows. And so, you know, there's no fishing in the Rubicon. Like you got to keep going for better or worse, right? That's probably going to involve a lot of pain. I'm not saying that's like a wonderful thing that I wish on the country or the world, whatever, but just like the reality is probably we're not turning back just because of, you know, a procedural dispute over how Trump does it.
No, there isn't a turning back. And they're getting more explicit with this too. I mean, it's not directly connected to the tariff ruling from the Supreme Court and the quick pivot right after, but I'm not sure if you saw, and I don't know if this was an old clip that resurfaced last week. I'm pretty sure it was a new interview, but Marco Rubio was on Fox News talking about the fact that the dollar reserve status is not ever going to be what it used to be. Like the world is moving towards a multipolar, multi-currency sort of regime, and the U.S. has to be prepared for that. And so that was, and again, I don't recall if it was a resurfaced clip. I'm pretty sure it was a fresh clip from last week. And I was like, wow, the fact that they're actually admitting this on Fox News is pretty, not startling, but pretty crazy just to see.
Yeah, I didn't see the clip and I don't know if it's new or not, but I think it aligns with everything that they, you know, spent 2 weeks in Davos saying like last month, right? Telling the global elite how things were going to change. And, you know, everyone from Trump to Vance to the trade rep, Jameson Greer, you know, he gave a speech to that effect, basically calling for like a new Hamiltonian system to people in Europe. And so, I mean, like there's been too much kind of publicly said about like all this, and yeah, you're not gonna be able to put that genie back in the bottle now. So yeah, I just think there's still a lot of heel dragging in kind of mainstream thinking, and you know, that's just at odds with reality. And the other kind of big headline that led me to think about like reality distortion field over the weekend was just the Fed minutes that came out this past week, which is basically had, interestingly, like had suggested, you know, we've still got this divided Fed. We're still kind of like arguing over the path of rate cuts and how fast should they go? How many should we have this year? You've got some officials saying, well, maybe we should have two-sided language to suggest that there's still a possibility for rate hikes later in the year, you know, very much opposed to the direction that the administration wants to take things, and, you know, potentially opposed to what's even theoretically doable and feasible with the path of, you know, the budget and the administration's priorities this year and the next few years. And so that kind of whole narrative, this whole like hand wringing about should we go 25 basis points now or should we wait 3 months, like whatever, I found to be very at odds with the latest Treasury documents on the quarterly refunding announcement that they put out every quarter, just highlighting the expected budget funding and deficits and a bunch of different dynamics that go into what they're going to need to go to market with. And so if you pull up that second chart, I think it really speaks nicely to exactly the divide at play here between kind of, you know, what the Fed thinks it can do and what Treasury thinks it's going to do. It's a bit of a complicated chart, but basically the red bars on top of the blue bars are, if you can see down at the bottom, SOMA bill purchase effects. So this is the idea of what the Fed is going to absorb on its balance sheet from Treasury bill issuance. So like short dated bills. And this maps roughly, you're just eyeballing it here, but maps roughly to about like $480 billion annually, which if you remember the pace of the RMP program, so reserve management purchases from December 25, was like $40 million a month initially, and then that was supposed to kind of come down and be, you know, kind of roll off to like 20 or less over time. Well, 480 is 40 times 12. And so I don't know that they're necessarily just kind of like flatlining that pace. But either way, like this speaks to an assumption that the Fed is going to be out there buying more bills consistently for the next like at least 8 years, than on a much more consistent pace and at a much higher clip than Powell was suggesting in December when they first rolled out the RMP concept. And so I think this chart is basically telling you like net new information relative to at least like Treasury's assumption about what's going to happen versus what the Fed was originally pitching, where a couple of months ago, where the RMPs were supposed to be, you know, front loaded at 40 and then slowly kind of roll off and not necessarily be necessary for all that long. This is looking at them. This is looking at that kind of program as something that is going to be a structural buyer that's in place for many years to come. And so that's piece one of just like, we've got the hand wringing at the Fed, dithering over like, you know, what we should do with like short end rates, and maybe we should even raise rates. And meanwhile, Treasury is kind of doing the Leroy Jenkins thing and just saying, you know, no, we're going to be, you can have whatever conversations you want on rates, but we're explicitly building funding plans and the budget with your consistent participation at these levels. That's number one on this chart.
And correct me if I'm wrong, RMP was instituted to help smooth over overnight repo spasms?
Yeah. So like the language around it was about kind of ensuring adequate, I forget their exact language. They've got like three gradations of like reserve levels in the banking system. There's ample, and then like something that means like sub ample. And I forget, but there are like three of them. But we had moved allegedly into a regime of like less than, you know, fully excessive and starting to get into like a somewhat less comfortable position in the banking system. And so RMP was among other kind of factors intended to address the what was being seen as like an increasing move toward like a shortfall of or a scarcity of reserves in the bank system, and also smooths over, you're right, the repo dynamics that were acting up a lot more late last year and have smoothed out a little bit early this year. So this is like, stop to your point, I think, like kind of stopgap type of funding that we can eventually roll off, surprise surprise, is assumed to actually become something kind of structural and consistent and long term in nature.
Yeah. Nothing is, there's no such thing as a temporary government, government policy. No, it's the sort of conflict of what's actually happening behind the scenes and what they're saying during these meetings, the FOMC meetings, can be more stark. It's like, well, you're saying maybe we need to hike rates. There we go. We may need to. And then the back end, you're injecting liquidity to make sure that everything's okay in the overnight banking system.
Yeah. The other piece on this chart that people may notice is, you know, you got these blue dots and these orange dots up on top, and it's hard to read the legend, but basically the blue dots are the CBO's estimates for borrowing, for deficits over this period. This may just be gross borrowing, not deficits, but either way, the CBO and even the OMB, like both significantly higher, you'll notice, than the total amount that Treasury's forecasting. And, you know, I think it's also like, I believe what this is telling you is Treasury is taking a very optimistic view of the borrowing that will be necessary over this time period relative to what's already baked into, say, the CBO estimates, which are famously themselves usually too conservative relative to what actually plays out if you look on like a, you know, 5 year forward kind of basis. So I think this chart is also effectively assuming like that we, because of GDP growth and because of having, you know, the AI productivity boom and miracle that we're going to have, that worst and best and think we're going to have, you know, we can move into a period of much less borrowing and smaller deficits, thanks to that, the massive growth in the real economy that we're going to have. And so as I look at this, I'm also like, even the gross amount is like pretty rosy of what you'd have to borrow. And if the idea is, as the QRA documents we're talking about for this cycle, one of the big focus points is how can you manage the degree to which private balance sheets have to absorb incremental treasury issuance. And so if the idea is that we want to hold that blue bar down to these levels, or at least keep the proportions the same, but the total amount has to actually be a lot higher than we're showing here, and it looks more like the blue dots or the orange dots than the bars that are shown on the page, then you get to a position where it's like, well, the backfill is going to have to be that effectively the red bar has to get a lot higher, right? So not only are we assuming that something like RMP continues on a consistent basis for much longer, maybe even to if there's a hitch in the AI story, if we don't get crazy GDP growth, if we have even modest recession, if AI takes even a small amount of white collar jobs and you need a lot more spending on the back end, or if we need even more aggressive ramping in national defense spending, whatever, perhaps that red bar also has to even itself get a lot higher effectively, right? So I think, again, just there's this like this conflict between what we want to happen. Yeah. What we hope can happen and what our assumptions suggest can happen. And then kind of like what reality is throwing at us. And so, again, some reality distortion kind of at play in our key institutions here.
How do you think Bitcoin? I mean, it's obviously it's not going to play into these privately held net marginal borrowing markets, but it will be affected by the policy as it's instituted at the time it's instituted, as we know. Similarly with government policies, the projections are always way off base. So I think it's safe to assume that these bar charts will be much larger when, as time passes and we actually get to the point where they have to make the decisions on the issuance of these treasuries and these these RMP facilities. Where does Bitcoin play? I think bringing Bitcoin in now, particularly just talking about the elephant in the room, which is Bitcoin's performance over the last 6 months, or the last 4 months, really, since it hit all-time high in late October, early November. We had another drop-off last night. If we go on the one-day chart, we puked up. We're recovering from them. But obviously, in the last month, we had the fall from 90K to 62K, tapped 59K at one point, hovering at 65,850 right now. Many people are wondering what's going on with Bitcoin. It's supposed to be this digital gold asset. It's supposed to, we talked about it a few weeks ago, Bitcoin is not a hedge, but many people perceive it to be such. And people are looking at Bitcoin's performance, particularly juxtaposed to gold, silver, and even the NASDAQ, and looking at this massive disconnect and are worried. Is Bitcoin broken? Is it dead? What's going on here?
Yeah, it's definitely a point of concern that we think about all the time as folks who are highly levered to Bitcoin's price action. I mean, there's the old saying that Bitcoin is dumpiest before pumpiest. And I think that's a very, very technically sophisticated way to look at it. But, I think probably like it's maybe a little overdone at this point, depending on how on Bitcoin Twitter you are. But I do think there's a degree of accuracy in the idea that Bitcoin is this liquidity smoke alarm. And, you referenced your talk with Michael Howell earlier. I won't spoil that for people and can't wait to listen to it. But, it's pretty clear that we have not had in the last few months, if you've been following his work or anyone else who tracks like similar metrics, a major liquidity tailwind. You've had, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet over, a lengthy time period, you've had these major step ups in the size of the balance sheet. And then we had a few years of, QT runoff that was very aggressive, kind of backfilled by activist treasury issuance. You've talked about it a good deal on your show, treasury shifting much more to front end issuance. And that was a pro liquidity impulse for a while. But, we may be running up on the limits of that, especially when we also now are looking to spend much more into the real economy and potentially out of financial assets. We're giving a bid to, manufacturing, we're giving a bid to data center construction, we're giving a bid to industrials and defense. And, increasingly there's less potentially capital out there in a non-Fed supportive world to flow into, classic financial assets. And so I think to me, the story of the Fed's balance sheet really tells the tale. We're kind of flatlined now at this. We basically came back down right to where that level went to during kind of spring 2020. So we've worked off everything post, call it like May, June 2020, which frankly, it's pretty incredible that Bitcoin did what it did against that kind of like monetary base headwind. And now we're just kind of hanging out, right? And I think it's going to be, I think the market is digesting a lot of, is digesting that, digesting the AI story and how that's going to affect a lot of different asset classes, which we could maybe get into. And then I think digesting also like, what is the stance of this incoming Fed? You know, if Warsh gets confirmed, which is not a given, is he going to be, you know, fully subordinate to the Treasury's, or let's say in partnership with, you know, what Treasury wants to do and what Bessent wants to do? And what will that actually mean in terms of like liquidity, broad liquidity support and the direction of the Fed balance sheet? I have, you know, as we just discussed, I have my suspicions about where that ultimately ends up. But historically, you also have needed like some kind of crisis panic moment for policymakers, especially monetary policymakers, to really kind of recognize, to get out of their reality distortion field, recognize the situation that they're in, and you know, step on the gas to do the only thing that they really can do, right? So I think we're in kind of a holding pattern of processing a lot of different crosswinds. And yeah, it's tough to say what the next 36 months are going to look like, not just for Bitcoin, but you know, for everything.
Yeah, and it will be interesting if some sort of liquidity crisis emerges between now and Warsh's nomination process, because what do you think Jerome Powell would do in the interim? Sort of a lame duck Fed chairman right now. And like, you could see the politics around that. If there's a liquidity crisis that emerges between now and Warsh's likely nomination, and Jerome Powell's tasked with fixing a problem that arises, I could see him putting his hands up saying, hey, I'm about to leave. I don't want to make any decisions that the new Fed chairman will not like. And I don't know, I'm just thinking on the go here, but that could be an interesting situation.
Yeah, I think ultimately every Fed chair does the same thing, like when push comes to shove. So I don't know like how strong his stomach would be to just kind of let, you know, to lose the long end or to let equity indices fall like 30% just to basically give Trump the middle finger, especially because that allows Trump to paint like a wonderful narrative that this idiot Powell kept rates too high. And then when, you know, the moan of truth, when he could have saved the economy, he stepped back. And, you know, there's a reason for the DOJ to, you know, put Powell in jail for life. Right. So if I'm him, I probably, you know, I don't know if I want to try to be a hero on that basis. I don't really think that he would throw his hands up and just kind of like do nothing. I think the pressure is going to be too great from a variety of fronts. But also, Powell doesn't necessarily have, you know, I can't remember the exact mechanics by which like the decisions get made by the FOMC. But, you know, it isn't ultimately Powell's final decision. And
well,
so
if one vote on a board of 12.
Yeah, right. So if there are a bunch of governors who are to say like, yeah, you may be gone in 3 months, but I'm here for the next like 10 years or whatever. And also I'm trying to retire on a reasonable time frame as well. And my bags need to be sufficiently pumped. I don't necessarily think that there's going to be a ton of appetite for just outright 08 type, you know, collapse.
Yeah. Over 26 minutes. We're trying to keep this at 30 minutes. I know you said there's some stuff in the real world economy we could expand on, but let's push that to next week, because we do need to pat ourselves on the back. I mean, we warned everybody who was listening, I think a few weeks ago now at this point, that there were many people out there saying that the precipitous fall in Bitcoin's network hash rate a few weeks ago and the large downward difficulty adjustment of 11.7% was a signal that miners are leaving the Bitcoin network because of quantum fears and a transition to HPC compute to service the expanding AI economy. Well, time has passed and we've had yet another difficulty adjustment, and it was a rather large upwards difficulty adjustment of 14.6% towards the end of last week. And that was because hash rate stormed back on the network, pun intended. And I think it's become clear in retrospect that the fall in hash rate that we witnessed a few weeks ago was due to the large winter storm that blew through the country, which necessitated that miners that are participating in demand response programs turned down to make sure there was enough electricity supply on the grids when the temperature dropped and people turned on their heating systems. And on top of that, I think there was also a number of mining facilities that were literally shut down because of inches of ice that overtook their operations. But time passed, the sun came out, the temperature rose, things thawed out, demand for electricity on the grid fell, and miners were able to turn back on.
Yeah, I think we were making that exact case. a couple of weeks ago. So not super surprising that it played out. The cynic in me looks at this and says, well, this is just a dead cat bounce. But I the optimist, which wins out, says that it's just all part of the long term trend of hash rate pumping forever. But yeah, the one thing I'll say here is like there were a lot of like tourism posts over the last couple of weeks pointing out this chart and saying, well, obviously, you know, it's a combination of hash price is so low and a lot of miners are capitulating and they're going to be net sellers forever. And also like they're just pivoting into AI and HPC capacity. And here, that's the reason for all this. And I would just say like, look, boys, like the last like 2 years has been like the HPC story didn't start like last week, right? Like this entire chart that you're seeing here, like HPC has been alive and well as like a, you know, a mining diversifier story for like multiple years across this entire chart. And yet hash rate continued to pump, right? Like hash price has been in a narrow band, or, you know, not a very impressive band, but a narrow band of like 30 to 50 bucks a petahash for basically this entire time that you're seeing on this chart, and hash rate continued to pump, right? So we can get into like maybe on another episode what that means and who might be driving that. But you know, to look at like a 2 week chart here and say, well, it must be because HPC or it must be because hash price and miner death spiral, whatever, like, you know, you're identifying forces that have been at play for years at this point. And despite all that, like hash rate was up into the right, like the entire time, basically. So, you know, maybe as always, zoom out a little bit. Don't make any reads based on a 2 week chart and, you know, think through how some of the trends at play have been affecting it for longer than that.
And check the weather. Check the weather.
And check the weather.
Yeah. Yeah, just last thing there, tie it up. I mean, one, like there was quantum people out there saying, I mean, that's the least valid of any of the arguments is put out there. AI, HPC compute, we know there's publicly listed Bitcoiners that are openly and aggressively transitioning to AI data centers, and that's okay. But like to think that that transition would result in just like a precipitous fall in hash rate is idiotic. Like these are businesses that are run well. I mean, if they're going to diversify out of Bitcoin into AI, HPC, compute, they're going to sell their machines. And who are they going to sell them to? They're going to sell them to people that want to plug them in. So yes, individual mining operations may be pivoting to AI compute, but they're going to sell their rigs. They're not just going to unplug them and sit on them. That would be a waste of capital, shareholder value, if you will. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention here is quickly escaping me. But in that same vein, I think, and we could talk about this another time. The big, beautiful bill, I think, bring hash price into perspective. It is relatively low, not impressive, but I think there are countervailing forces, particularly via tax policy, that are making people sort of price agnostic in terms of hash price because of the sort of depreciation write-offs they can get by buying mining equipment and plugging it in. So yeah, that was the timestamp recap. A little over 30 minutes. John, thank you for writing. Thank you for joining me. Very much enjoying the show. I hope you are too.
Same here. Look forward to every week.
All right. See you guys next week.